Hello, and welcome to another edition of Kaleidoscope. This is Magda Zenon, recording from downtown Nicosia, and with me is my new best friend, Catherine Ferran, from Northern Ireland. She can tell her city because I always get confused. She's a domestic abuse educator and activist, and she does things quite creatively. Welcome, Catherine, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Magda. Yes, I am from Northern Ireland, in the capital city of Northern Ireland, which is Belfast, where I was born and grew up, and still am in the same place. In fact, I live and work within a 5 mile radius of where I grew up. So I haven't moved much, even though I love to travel. I haven't moved much from this. I haven't moved off this island to live anywhere else. I've always lived in Northern Ireland. I've always lived in Belfast, in the north of Belfast. And I grew up during the conflict, which was better known as the Troubles. So people often ask me, why did I get into this type of work? I think growing up in a normal, for me as a child, in a normal atmosphere, it was always tense with violence or the threat of violence, not only in the streets where I played and lived and went to school, but also in my home. My father was a perpetrator of, I would call it, domestic terrorism against my mother and myself, being the eldest and the only girl, and my four younger brothers were really terrorized in our own home with what's really known more so now as a behavior called coercive control. So in between bouts of violence, physical violence against my mother, he would have been very controlling with her, and then because we were the children being looked after, we were also controlled.
But
So
you know what happens,
that's
Catherine? I think when people ask you that question, when you grow up in a troubled environment, whether within the home or within the context of the country, you either disconnect completely or you get involved and do something about it. And it's a lot easier to disconnect, I think. It's a lot more challenging to step in and take the bull by the horns, face your demons, and do something, no matter how much you do or how little you do, but actually find a way of dealing with it constructively and communally. So I think that's I also get the question, why in South Africa they would say to me, why are you fighting apartheid? You're privileged. Let's say, excuse me? Did you actually hear what you said? I'm privileged, but the person next door to me is not privileged. So that's a no-brainer. But tell me more. I mean, I think the troubles, as you call them, in Northern Ireland cannot not have affected every single one of you.
Yes, every single person living here, no matter what side they lived on. So the conflict is known between people who live and are from Northern Ireland who associate and affiliate with United Kingdom, and the other, which is the community I was from, we would have felt that we were Irish and we affiliated ourselves with and associated ourselves with the idea of having a free Ireland, a full island where it was all Irish, where you could be Irish, you could be nationalistic with your flag, which is the green, white and orange, the Irish flag. But because Northern Ireland, when I was growing up, was majority was people, PUL, Protestant Unionist Loyalist, so they affiliated with the Union Jack or the Union flag of Britain. So when you, and I believe all of us suffered in different ways, but we all definitely suffered. And the legacy of that is still very much felt even now. So the two worlds of intimate partner violence and community violence against each other became, for me, one big cycle of violence. So it wasn't one or the other. The two of them I met in my small child life together. And it was interesting for me that I went to an all-girls Catholic school and that they talked about, you know, suffer little children, and that Jesus adored the little children and told others, adults off, don't be shooing them away, let them come. I remember all of this, going through all the sacraments that you do when you grow up in Catholicism, you have your Holy Communion day with your white dress, you have the Holy Communion, the body of Christ. You become then at 11 with your confirmation, a soldier of Christ, full of the Holy Spirit, where you get your strength from and your courageousness from. And all of those things did not marry for my real life. The two things were separate. I went to school, it was all little children and Jesus, and then I walked home, avoided bullets, bombs. We had curfews, we had to stay inside. The more I stayed inside, the more the violence from the father. So it was. You said disconnect. I did disconnect. I disconnected quite a lot as a child into a dream world of movies that I would have been impressed with, Disney, Bambi, The Jungle Book, all of those things I reenacted in the streets with my friends. We sang the songs, we pretended we were the characters. Then we started to make up our own stories. Some of us would play the enemy. So, for example, young children growing up watching my father's and mother's age, born in the 1940s, they grew up watching cowboy movies. So this group would be the Indians, and this group would be the cowboys, and the cowboys were the best, and the Indians were the enemy. So we did the same. So I would get our friends and go, right, well, you're British Army, and you're the police, and you're the state, you're the oppressors. And this other gang that I was always in was the Irish people stuck in an island where we weren't acknowledged, we were subjected to oppression and all the stuff that was fed into your real life growing up in a one-sided identity.
It's actually amazing when you grow up and you do a little bit of reflection, when you realize what you're subjected to and how your little, not little, little and naive and immature brain needs to find a balance between what you're feeling, what you're seeing, what you're learning, whether it's within the home or within the school or within your friends. And when you come out on the other side and you look at yourself, and some of us look at ourselves and think, you know what? I'm actually not a bad human being. You think, damn, I must have done something right when I was little in balancing all these things that were playing a role in my life, whether intentionally or unintentionally. And every one of us has faced violence in some way, whether externally in the environments we lived in, the context, or in the home or at school. We've all faced some kind of violence. Maybe not directly. I might not have been beaten up, but I've seen people being beaten up. Or I've known friends that have had domestic violence. Or I've seen the violence that the South African racist government exerted on the Black Indigenous population and the humiliation. So we've all lived it in some way. And you come out on the other side, and you either come out thinking, I need to do something, regardless of my privilege or not, or I can't manage, which is also fine. Everyone deals with it in their way. There's no right and wrong. Or I can't manage it, and I'm going to stay in my little bubble and carry on. So tell us how you dealt with it, because you've dealt with it in a quite a creative way, which I really admire, because I think academia has its role. Creativity in any form actually is the way more people understand.
That was how I understood. I mean, it was cathartic as a child, I suppose. So they say that when you're faced with anything, any kind of trauma, the amygdala, which is our oldest ancient part of our brain, I believe, always holds on to what worked, what keeps you alive. Now, sometimes the amygdala will do it where then people have PTSD and all the rest of it. And I mean, my understanding of it now is much more obviously than I understood at the time. But I remember feeling very isolated, very unseen, very insignificant as a young human being. I mistrusted adults so much. So there was pockets of happiness that you grab, but when I look back on it, was quite a miserable start. Being the eldest and being a female, I also took on the role of confidant of my mother, and so felt that I needed to look after her and also my younger brother. So when there was fighting going on downstairs and we were supposed to be sleeping in bed, I would sing nursery rhymes, play games, bring
To cover
home
the
to
noise.
you. Yeah, distraction. So I felt an awful sense of responsibility at a very young age. So I really feel that the domestic violence at home and the adult conflict about the island and who should be Irish and who shouldn't, I felt very angry for a long time because I felt that it was taken. My childhood was taken from me because of what, because people could not be adults and work things out in a peaceful way. So I was quite angry. And have you ever watched the movie Matilda?
Yes.
About a young girl who's like really she wishes she was adopted, like she just didn't fit in with her family. Now I wasn't clever like Matilda, and I'm not an avid reader. But I when I watched that as an adult, I thought I felt a bit like that because I was very liberal in my views. My parents would have shouted at the news and shouted about the other, and where I felt very well, everybody, you know, we all need to just get along. And my mother in particular used to get quite angry with me because I was so in between, in the middle, where she was like full of this, I would say hatred for anything British and for Protestant community generally, because they stole our piece of land and we should be an all island. There's 32 counties in Ireland, and six of them, in which is where I live, and in the six counties, is occupied then by Britain, by the British people. So she was very angry. So I couldn't have a conversation with her. I couldn't speak to my family about what where I was. I was quite in the middle and wanted everybody just to stop hurting each other. And so anyway, with all of that going on, I felt quite detached. So I felt a bit like Matilda in that sense. So I had to keep those thoughts in. I had to keep the tears in. I had to pretend to be brave. I did develop resilience, but I wouldn't wish it on any other child in my life or any other person to go through what I went through. So I found while playing in the street when we were playing our games, I would have been quite the one to say, "You be this role," and I would write the script almost, and we just developed as we played along. So that felt cathartic. So the amygdala then kicks in as I get older and I'm trying to process the anger that's suppressed, which isn't good. I was struggling with just being very angry, especially with men, anybody in authority, whether it's a taxi driver or a male doorman at a restaurant or anywhere at all. If they looked at me sideways, I would have
Whack
rah,
them.
don't look at me. So I needed to sort that out in my head. So I felt then, I worked then with victims of domestic and sexual violence for 20 years in Belfast and Lisburn Women's Aid.
Well, you're a trained psychotherapist. What kind of
Oh,
training did you have?
no, I was in a support role. I was a practitioner. I worked as a aftercare worker, a family worker. I was a refuge manager and then became part of the senior management team. No, we had our in-house training on trauma and psychological trauma and intergenerational trauma, but not, no, I wouldn't. I did counselling. I trained as a counsellor, but only used the skills as opposed to sitting down in a therapeutic sense. So
Okay.
all of my stuff was very, very practical and no psychotherapy, nothing like that at all. And then my own experience, of course,
Which
just
in
gives me
most
that.
cases, that's invaluable.
Pardon?
Which in most cases is invaluable when we actually draw on own experiences, you actually realize how much natural wisdom you have, I think.
Yes, and I think it communicates without saying. I did not sit with hundreds of women over 20 years and go, "Well, what happened to me was that didn't that that wasn't the way." They just knew. They knew by my body language, my tone, my silence, my information that I was giving them, or the paraphrasing of what they've just told me, and that deep innate understanding. So I think that communicated. And I do believe I was a very effective support worker to anyone that came in because of that. But what I was more interested in, because I joined a drama group, an amateur drama group at 21, and I loved it so much, and I started to get parts in the play, and I then became a proficient performer. So I married the two of those together. So my passion for raising awareness around domestic abuse and violence in communities with my love and my skills that I picked up over the years in acting. So when we were doing conferences or anything with Women's Aid, I suggest at once that we maybe don't do a PowerPoint. Why don't I write something and perform a monologue? So that's what I did the way back, maybe 2012, 2014. So it was the first time I've done something publicly that wasn't someone else's script. So it was a 15-minute monologue,
Is the Sarah
depicting.
story?
Know that the one I did first was Growing Old with Domestic Violence. So it was a conference that we were doing about raising the awareness and shining the light on older women's experience of domestic abuse, because oftentimes people think it's for younger women. But if you are abused at 20 when you meet someone, that abuse continues if you're married or you're in a partnership with them for the rest of your life.
Can
And
I
as
also
I was getting old,
can I interrupt you? Can I interrupt you there? I've also realized we've been doing some work now, and we've had some events now related to gender-based violence, and it's directed more to younger women. Okay. And I thought to myself, you know what? The older I get, I've fortunately never been really a victim of gender-based violence, a big victim of gender-based violence. But the older I get, the more vulnerable I feel. Okay. And now I've never locked the doors driving in my car in Cyprus. Never. Suddenly, I'm locking the doors. And I think us older women are grossly neglected in that field about the fact that the older you get, just because nothing happened to you before your 65th birthday, when you pass that threshold, your body is not as strong, so you do feel vulnerable. So you do need, and you often are a victim of violence, whether it's scamming online or pickpocketed or mugged or whatever. So I do think it, we under generally society undervalues or underestimates how truly vulnerable older women are.
Yeah,
Sorry,
absolutely.
I interrupted you. So carry on. I just
No, you're
needed to.
okay. No, I'd like to hear your thoughts on whatever's coming up for you as well. I mean, as an adult, I haven't experienced intimate partner violence. So what people would have said, social workers and psychologists, everyone used to say that children were witnesses to the violence, and they've changed that a long time ago to experienced it. And we know vicarious trauma can actually sometimes be a heavier burden rather than going through something yourself. So witnessing and experiencing and feeling helpless. And I think part of me wanting to raise my voice and raise other women's voices who feel that they can't speak was because of the times where I felt I couldn't do anything. So the background noise to the screams and the smashing was crying children. Now, as my brothers got older, they would have tried to intervene, and that wasn't a good idea either because mum would have got it worse. But I remember feeling, you know, where there's the fight flight.
Yes.
There's the fight flight, freeze, flop, and friend. And I think I used every one of those strategies when I was witnessing or going through that.
To go through them again, fight,
So
flight.
we know fight, we fight our way, or we know flight, which is we run away. I would have used flight, run away at either being in the same home but being away from out of here into my dream world. And then we have freeze, which is you're totally
Freeze. You don't know what to, you just freeze.
you're not fighting, you're not flighting, you're not doing anything. Flop is when you're so totally overwhelmed, and you find that women who have PTSD because of domestic abuse will quite often have blackouts that aren't, you know, there's scans done of their brain, but there's nothing actually there, but the trauma is just overwhelming. And the last one is very interesting for me. It's called fawn or friend. And that's when we put our hands up to show we're not threatening you. Please, what would you like, a cup of tea? What can I do for you? Whatever you want. So the friend is the one that women would use quite often when they're in an intimate relationship where there's violence, especially sexual violence. is that they would use the friend. The friend is the bit that keeps them safe. It's
Okay.
calming him down. So I would have used friend, try to be nice to daddy. I would have used frozen and freeze. Froze, sorry, freeze and
Flop.
flop. Yeah. But anyway, so I think that's another reason why when I got older and I started to learn about domestic violence and all of the different elements and the complexity of it, when I was learning how to be a good, effective practitioner, I could see what the cycle of violence was. I learnt about the course of control, and just for my mother's sake, my mother Teresa, she left my father when she was 60 years old. She was with him from she was 20, and she left him when she was 60 years old.
Wow, that's brave.
So growing old with domestic abuse was everything that I do. My mother is in the story, and she was very much in that story. So she left and came and lived with me and my husband and family for about 8 months, and then she got a lovely wee bungalow house close to us. And she had 15 years of life where she traveled and did whatever she wanted without looking over her shoulder.
That's so
So
brave of her to leave at the age of 60.
it was because she was so frightened. She was never on her own before. She left her mother and father's home. She got married and was never on her own. And that was one of the reasons why she could never leave. She tried to leave a few times before, but it was when she was 60 that, because she was starting to become suicidal, and in fact did end up in intensive care with one attempt. So she knew she had to get away, and she did. So this play, Growing Old with Domestic Violence, is based on her, but not exactly her. So I based it on, she was a young woman in the 60s, and Dusty Springfield's song was out in 1963, I think. I don't know what it is that makes me love you so. I
I remember
only
that
know
song.
I never want to let you go. 'Cause you started something, can't you see? That ever since that day you've had a hold on me. So that song I start my play with. All excited about getting married. And at the very end, when I show the age difference and what's going on, she's sitting, you call her Helen in the play. She's sitting with a 50-year-old, happy 50th anniversary. She's telling the audience that he is now in his bed, and he refuses any nurses to come, and so she has to go. He bought her a watch on their anniversary, but the watch was always, "What time do you think this is? What time are you coming back at? Why were you so long away?" And now the watch is, "I need to get him toileted. I need to change him. I need to feed him. I need to give him his medicine. I need to. So the card has still got the wrapper on it. It's their 50th wedding anniversary. And she said to the audience, "I can't fill this in." And she sings the song again. And she goes, "I don't know what it is that makes me love you so. I only know I never want to let you go. 'Cause you started something. Can't you see that ever since that day you've had a hold on me?" And she drops the card. So the song tied in the story of what should have been happy, what should have been wonderful, what should have been an adventure in a life together. But when I heard that song and I thought, "Oh my God," the words, like, when you're in love, you've got a hold on me is a good thing. But when the audience just watched 15 minutes of what happened through the years, I
They
just thought,
understand the control, that it's
yeah.
not. You've made me cry. Just hearing that last part, you've made me
I
cry.
know. I know, because the words are the exact same. When she's ironing his shirt, I always start off with a domestic chore in my plays. I don't know why. But she's ironing the shirt and she has it on a hanger and she's dancing. But at the end, I usually make my voice a lot croakier and slower. But it's like the card falls. It's a light card, but the impact, I think, is boom. Oh my goodness. So that's what I start. That was my first, and I've written a few others. The Sarah story that you referred to has brought in the coercive control within communities now, because the legacy of the Troubles has left gangs of men who would have normally been freedom fighters or defenders of the country, and there's a lot of criminality and control, especially over women in certain parts of Northern Ireland. So my play is not only about intimate partner relationship, where there's coercive control, but he is also part of one of those gangs. So the community are also monitoring her, as well as him. And that's Sarah's story.
Do you do these within a group, or do you do these publicly? The
Both.
performances?
I would do both. However, people just recently from, do you have soroptimists?
Yes, but I don't know what they do, but I know the word, the group.
Aye, they're usually other professional women who were retired, and they anyway, I got a phone call recently from them, and they wanted me to do my 15-minute Sarah's story. They wanted me to travel quite a bit actually, and just pop in and do it and go. And I was like, I don't know who told you about what I do, but that's not what I do. My performance is not about the performance. It's part of a workshop. So I will. It's not a popcorn night out kind of a play. I don't. It's to communicate to the audience the depths of the impact of what goes on in people's homes, and the injustice of it all. So it's I would open up with a couple of exercises. It's all interactive. So I would get people to feel what that must be like. We'll look at what the definitions of coercive control are. We'll look at the cycle of violence. And as I say, I'll do a few exercises. There's one I do with a balloon and the noise of a balloon. I invite them to sit quietly just to get them to feel something in their body. And then I'll keep referring back to remember the balloon feeling. And then I'll do my story. Then I'll ask them to pick the themes that they saw within the performance so that enhances their understanding of what we had discussions on. So it's like, to give it any justice, it should be a half a day, like 2.5 hours, or 3 hours with a break. So I said to her, sorry, I won't pop in and go at it, and then walk back out again, because that would be an injustice to the story of these women. So Sarah's story has mum's element in it, along with three other women that I worked with that I brought home with me for many, many years. And I relay that story, obviously changed names, everything's not the same, but I won't be doing that for I won't be tap dancing like a seal for anyone, because it's the 16 days of activism. And they thought, oh, I know, she can come and do her wee thing. So I was quite annoyed,
No,
I have to say.
I agree with you, because a lot of, as you know, I do the beadwork workshop, which in itself sounds, oh, cute, she's going to make a necklace. But in
Oh,
fact, it's not. It might
no.
have the, like yours, it has the visual of being fun and creative and ha ha ha, and let's do a tap dance, but it's not. It's actually just a gentler way of allowing people to open up. And you, I can create a necklace, and to me, it's a necklace of a good balance, whatever life. And you can look at that necklace and think, what the hell? This is not what I'm seeing. And you see different things. So I agree with you. We all recognize ourselves in each other's stories, but in different ways, I think. We see different aspects. I'll see what you're telling me things now, and the things that I picked up from your whole stories. This probably explains that why I, as a child, lived in a book. I read my entire childhood. My dad had a restaurant next to the city library.
Yeah.
And at some stage, the chief librarian went to my dad and said, "But why is your daughter still coming? She's read every book in the library, including the encyclopedias." And I think there's a part of me that loved it because it, I mean, stories and words and imagination, but it's also, in a lot of ways, isolating and lonely, because it's just you and the book, and no matter how much imagination and immersed you get in a book, it can be quite isolating and lonely. And I mean, the violence I faced in my family is, my father had a restaurant downtown, and it was a restaurant during the time of the Hells Angels and the increase in drug violence. So my father was in the middle of this, and my father was the 6-foot-tall, big human being that wasn't scared of walking into, he was 40 at the time, between 30, 40 and 50. I didn't have a problem into walking into a group of Hells Angels and whacking. Okay, this big hand. On weekends, I used to not go to sleep until he walked in safe. And it was, I mean, it wasn't intentional, but to me, the fact that he was in danger or potentially in danger was a very strong drain on my little soul. Oh, that's why I always had this weakness for my dad, and I excused everything he did, because I worried about him being in a place that was potentially not safe. And I mean, I remember I was 8 or 9 or 10, I would not sleep until I heard his key in the door. So we do face violence in different ways, but it made me think that even though I was privileged to live in a library and to enjoy all these books, and it also created a bond with my mother because we're both avid readers, it was also isolating and lonely.
But
Anyway.
I think people forget that, small people are people. Like, we're not stupid, you know. I know sometimes we think we're clever and we think we know everything in teenage years, but we really do need to listen to children, like when they're telling us stuff. Or, you know, and parents are afraid. If your father knew that you were worried sick, I'd probably be so upset,
Yes, it probably would have been
because
so
he was
upset.
doing everything to try and protect you from all of that. Because, you know, childhood's precious time. It's a very short time in our lives, and our
I mean,
parents.
he was working these long hours in this restaurant to keep me happy or to give me a good life and all my siblings. I'm sure he would have been devastated if he knew how
That you were worried so much
that
that
I
you were
was
so
worried
ill.
sick. I was worried sick that I would lose sleep until he got home. Night. The same way parents usually wait for their kids to come in every night, the same happened to me when I was a little girl, because I always had this weakness for my dad. I was always daddy's girl, but I was worried about him being safe.
Of
Worried about him
course.
being safe. Is this also to bring the listeners also up to date? You and I met in this really awesome Dialogue Academy for young women in Slovenia that brings together young women from Pristina and Belgrade. I mean, there's leadership training and storytelling and information and whatever. It's quite intense, and it's between relaxed and intense, because there's lighter parts. Is what you did, what you talk about, this theater creating, is that what you did with a young woman? Is that the kind of
Sorry.
thing? Is that the kind of thing you would have done at the training in Slovenia? Put
Oh
together
yeah,
a script.
I would have loved to have done that. I would have loved to have done that. And I think, you know, forum theater, you've heard of forum theater, where so for example, forum theater is, I saw a play one time and it was about human trafficking, and I was part of an audience, and once they did the scene, they would stop and then they would say to the audience, "What's your thoughts on what just happened?" And people could then direct the actors to do something different. So it's usually about social issues. So it was about human trafficking. It was about these guys and an older woman who had these young women in a house in Belfast. One of the young women, who was particularly thin and very pale, was seen by a neighbor looking all forlorn out of the window. The neighbor comes over and raps the door and goes, "Excuse me, how you doing? You're only new here. My name is..." Like, she was seen as a nosy neighbor. "I'm just worried about, there's a young girl I keep seeing. Oh, that's my..." And he goes, "Oh, that's my niece. She's fine. Oh, she hasn't been well. Da 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 da." And then they pack everything up the house and they move. So the audience then get to go, okay,
Why?
so
Why did he get? No, the
because
audience
they...
gets to think now, why did, following that conversation, why did the family leave?
Wasn't a family, it was traffickers who had six women and using it as a what do you call it?
Transition home.
No. To prostitute the young girls from.
So
So the
a
house was a
brothel. So
brothel. It was a
it was a
brothel, but
brothel. Oh, okay.
yes, but it was run by these men and this woman, who would then, you know, organize the girls, but the men would bring the girls and bring them out. So then the audience was asked, "What did you think of that scene?" Actually, that's not true. What happened was the neighbor was going to go and didn't wrap the door. So what the audience said was, I want the neighbor to wrap the door and see what and find out what's going on with that little girl. So then they changed the script because they pretended that they weren't in the first time. They didn't answer the door. So they kept doing what they were doing in that house. So the audience then said, tell the neighbor to come over and insist on getting into the house or to see that young woman. So what will happen is if neighbors do that, they put the girl and the rest of the girls in danger because all they're going to do is get them and lift them and move them before that nosy neighbor then rings the police to say of her concerns. Yeah. So what we were trying to do is raise awareness and tell the audience, these are the helplines that you must ring. This is what you must do. You shouldn't go there because all you're going to do is chase them from there to somewhere else. So forum theatre is about the audience being able to explore the dynamics of whatever they're presenting. So if it was domestic violence and I was doing it, then I would stop after each session, after one wee scene, and say, okay, what should she have done? And then I would just ad lib or take on what they said and see what happens so that they can stretch their understanding muscles around the complexities of domestic abuse. Why don't you just leave? You know, why don't you
We
just get
hear
up?
that every time. Why don't you just leave? I
Yeah.
think what I like about this forum theater is that you assume, firstly, why don't you just leave? And secondly, you often assume that direct intervention is good. And often
Yeah.
direct intervention is not the ideal solution. If there isn't another solution, yes, but often it can lead to more violence. And often it
Well,
can lead to death, okay? Because sometimes, and often it leads to flight, as you said. Just move the to move the prostituted woman
that's
further
right.
down.
Yeah. So the police here in Northern Ireland would say that the most dangerous time for a woman who's suffering domestic abuse or domestic terrorism at home is when she leaves and up to a year after she leaves. So I have seen three women on the television news that I would have worked with as a support worker, and over the years I've seen them on the news. Now women are on the news if they've achieved something like they've sailed around the world on their own, or they've done something and more incredible even than that, or they've won an award for something, or they're dead. And these women had not sailed around the world and they had not won any awards. So up until a year after, because the perpetrator is the one with all the power, even if she leaves, he will decide. He will decide whether this is over or not. And it means she's looking over her shoulder the whole time. So forum theatre is a great way, and I've done it in Erasmus when we were looking at critical thinking, and they used drama, and the audience was able to step in, either as the actor if they felt comfortable, or to give dialogue to, could that neighbour please rap the door so loudly that you have to answer? And then the cast all acted out and improvised. Then, okay, well, we're going to have to go because she knows there's a girl up there. She doesn't look well. She's seen all of our faces. She could ring the police. We've got to up and go. So forum theatre is very powerful, and I want to do more of that. I haven't done as much as I'd like, but I think it's a great way of really embedding that insight into any of those issues for real.
Yes, it's raising awareness with people of options they have when they see something. And it's also raising awareness about the fact that you cannot be an innocent bystander. You've got to get involved, but you also got to get thoughtfully involved, not just rash jump in and shoot people dead or whatever. You've got to think about what each action, and usually there is a helpline. Or a helpline at a police station, because some police stations are effective. There usually is a helpline with a professional that is more, has better tools of how to handle it in a way that's safer for the person that you're looking to protect.
I mean, you've got a lot of good people wanting to do good things, and social warriors, social guardians, even in organizations, NGOs that want to support. But really, the expert in this is the person who's suffering it. She will know when the good time to go. I mean, even say that was a domestic violence and someone came to the door and said, look, I'm hearing screaming, and then they ring the police, then the police come. She will be the one fixing her face, going to the door and going, hello, Oh no, it must have been the television. And he's standing behind listening to every single word. She is going to lie to her back teeth to those police officers because he's already hit the explosion stage of the cycle of violence. And she has to, because they'll take statements and go and walk away. Or they might lift him out of the house, take him down in their police van and drop him off round at his mother's. He'll walk back round again. So all these people have all these great ideas and put all these policies in. But when it comes to it, he is so omnipotent in her mind. He is so godlike that he can read her mind, that she has to navigate around his moods, his behaviors, social services, police. Doesn't matter who's at that door, she will be the best actress. She will get an Oscar for the acting that she will do to placate him, to stay alive another day, to see how she can escape. But just because outside agencies come along, and whether that's a neighbor or not, it doesn't mean that the violence is going to stop.
And it doesn't mean that she's ready to leave.
And it doesn't
Because
mean she's ready to leave. Now,
she's only ready to leave when she's ready to leave. It's like, you know, smoking is bad for you. Okay. But you only stop smoking when you've processed it, it's in your mind that now is the time that that's my decision, and now is when I'm ready to cut the addiction. Because I do think being in an abusive relationship is addictive. Because you're dependent on a personality. Someone's controlling your thinking, your movements. Am I right or am I wrong? If I'm wrong, please tell me.
I don't think it's an addiction. I think there's a codependency that happens. Obviously,
Okay.
if there's economic abuse and they have all the purse strings, but it sounds slightly, now this sounds harsh, but it sounds slightly victim blaming in that if you're going to break someone down slowly over years, like my mother was, for example, and it's drip, drip, drip. Your world becomes very, very small. Your resources become even smaller. You turn off your intuition, which women are wonderful at. It's our emotional brain. It's our gut feeling, because the gut feeling got her. Her gut feeling got her in trouble before because she made a decision without him. She actually made a decision to be with this person. So there's going to be that. Like, what did I do? I cannot be trusted with my own thoughts. Intuition's turned off because it's. What does he think? What does he want? He monopolizes all of the attention. There was a thing out years ago, all these rubber bands, then they became, for charities and things. But I remember a woman being in refuge and she had on it W, what would Jesus do? WWJD. And I said, what's that there? WWJD. And she said, oh, I'm a Christian. And this means what would Jesus do? So if I have a challenging issue or situation that I'm in, I will look at my band and I will pull my band and pray, what would Jesus do in this situation? How would Jesus, with passion and compassion and all the rest, how would he deal with it? And I tell this story all the time, and I'll go, say the perpetrator's name is Jim or John, what would Jim do? So the woman has this invisible band around her arm. No matter if it's even just to go for a coffee with someone or make a decision about doing a class or buy something in a shop, it's what would he do? So it's intuition's turned off. Your life, your insight and your life is very, very small because you've had to be small to keep safe. And options and choices are just, they disappear. So it's not so much like, because I smoke and I decide, I chose to smoke. I choose to smoke, even though I would consider myself an intelligent person. I still, and I need to look at that, right? But I don't think it's an addiction. I think it's a codependency and a feeling of what's the point now, where people are, I mean, they're doing investigations into suicide in women who have suffered domestic violence. And I think there was, I think someone was actually charged with it after the fact. They went back and looked at it again, and he's been charged with murder through the way he was treating her up until the point where it was suicide. So anyway, I don't think it's an addiction. Where an addiction at a point at the point of doing it for the first time is a choice, but afterwards, when you get hooked on something, But nobody, I don't need to be taking smoke into my lungs because I know every cigarette's harmful. But she doesn't have the choice of quitting like I have with cigarettes, because for her to quit is the statistic that the most dangerous time is when you leave. Do you know what I mean?
Yes,
I mean,
okay.
I will certainly die smoke if I keep smoking. I'll have a better life, better health, better, more money. Everything's positive if I stop.
No, you won't have more money. Trust me, I'm an ex-smoker, and that money you spend on cigarettes mysteriously disappears anyway.
I know. I
My
have
son
funny. I'm
used to
in
say to me, "Mom, stop smoking, and we'll have more money." And that then it was cheaper.
Yeah, it
And it
does.
doesn't go. I mean, that say 5 euros I used
Well,
to spend a month, or no, 20 euros I used to spend. That was not there, regardless of whether I smoked or not. But I agree with you. It maybe addiction is the wrong word, but there's a control that you can't get away from.
also then what they start doing, once they see they've pushed her to as far as they can push her in regards to demands and oppressing her, they start on the kids or your mother. If you don't do, I'm going to do this. I was just talking to a woman yesterday and she burst out crying because she said, "You asked me, was I still in contact with him?" And I said, "No, but I was lying. He just keeps ringing me. He said he's going to ring social services on my daughter, who's her daughter's struggling at the moment with her 8-year-old child. She lives on her own and the child's going to school unkempt." And her partner said, "I'm going to ring on you. I'm going to ring social services." So sometimes when they see that she is completely zombied out of any lust for life, and there's nothing else to get from her, if she doesn't comply, he will then start saying, "I'm going to say this. I'm going to tell your mother about the secret that you told me, the shame that you had when you were younger. I'm going to go to your grown-up daughter and ring social services and tell them she's a bad mother. I'm going to cause a lot of trouble if you
Don't do what I
leave
want, or
or
if
don't
you
do what
leave.
I want."
Because
So,
we're running towards the end of this conversation, is there any good advice you can give? If I think I'm witnessing, because I, as we said, I'm only going to leave when I'm ready to leave. If I think someone in my tribe or in my community, someone I love or care about, is a victim, what should I do? What should be my first point of call? Because I don't think, what should be my first point of call?
You're asking if someone you know in your community is suffering. You know there's something going on, but they've never
Yeah.
spoken to you about it. The first thing I wouldn't do is say, "Look, is everything all right at home? And can I help you in any way?" So, if they wanted to tell you, they will. I would befriend them. I would listen to them. I would try and enjoy their company, invite them for coffee, build up rapport. And then when that person, that woman usually, because it's mostly women who suffer this, but men also do, and that person then will find a time where they will share with you. Advice, no, listening, validating, and giving information around services is the best thing to do, because quite often women will lose friends because they've advised them, "You should leave him, and this is what you should do, and I'll go and I'll get you." And then the woman doesn't take that advice. So the friend goes, "I've already told Catherine, she could have stayed here. She decided to stay. Like, it mustn't be that bad. I mean, I'm having nothing more to do with her." Because the advisor friend feels aggrieved because she didn't take on she doesn't respect me. She didn't take on my advice. So I wouldn't be giving advice. I would be building a rapport to the point where the person might open up. And it's really about listening and validating. That sounds like a really horrible experience. It sounds like you're really suffering. What can I do to help you? It's just being there. It's not about giving out solutions. And as people, we want to help and we want solutions for them. And we get irked if they don't take this up. Because I used to actually get irked when women returned after staying 6 months in a refuge and go back, and then you'll see her 5 months later back in again. And then I had to sort of go, right, the door is always open, even though it's locked, but you have to leave it up to them. They are the experts in their life. Even if
Okay.
she tells you she might change her mind, she'll feel guilty because she'll feel like she's betraying him because she's locked in on this cloak of love that is domestic abuse with a cloak of love over it. I only do this because I love you. I only say these things because I feel so much for you. I wouldn't be so angry if you didn't do this, if you did this. So it's always her fault. And it's not, you don't always go around telling people if you feel like it's your fault. So rapport and listen and validate.
Okay, I think that's a good tone to end this conversation on. So the whole point is don't judge, just listen, have conversations, glasses of wine, cups of coffee, drives in the park or whatever, but never judge. Never judge and never have expectations. The person will open up to you when they are ready to open up to you. And the more you're around and the truer you are to yourself, because they can also smell out lack of authenticity. So when you're true to yourself and you listen and you listen and you're there for them, when they're ready, they will open up to you. And then again, don't judge, offer services, offer telephone numbers, and don't get upset if they leave and they go back again, because it's none of your bloody business. It's their life and they need
It's
to deal
none of
with
your
it.
bloody business.
It's
Yes.
they will leave when they're ready to leave.
That's right.
So, Catherine, I always love talking to you. Let's hope we can get a hold on this domestic violence, but one person at a time. That's all we can hope for. And I do love the way I like this forum theater, and I do think that the less we talk and the more we do creative stuff, the message is clearer, smoother, softer, because you don't actually feel as if you're doing therapy. You're doing something, you're having fun or thinking of something else. And in the meantime, you're either opening up, healing, or actually learning stuff. So carry on regardless, and look forward to catching up with you soon too.
Thank you so much. I think this is the 7th day of the 16 days of activism across the globe. So 16 days of activism, that's what we're doing right now. So thank you for inviting me. Good to see you as always, and I hope we get to meet in person again in the future.
Me too, and to all of us, let's stay safe and let's help the people around us stay safe as well by listening and being there.
Thank you.
Have a great rest of the day.
You too. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus, Island Talks. Open, diverse, free.